Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
You know how sometimes you have an idea of how you want something done? Like how you would have your living room decorated, your closet organized, or whatever. But you just haven't had the time to get around to it because the way it is right now is passable and it works. But in the back of your head, you know it could be better someday. Well, for Spirit Lake the Game, someday is today. At Seven Generation Games, we've rolled out a major update of our very first game. We've kept the parts that were already great and enhanced those areas where we saw potential for enhancements to give you a new version of the game that we know kids will love even more than the original. If you don't have Spirit Lake, well, what are you waiting for? Get it today. Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne Maria DeMars. And today, we're fortunate enough to have not one, but two amazing guests. So we have Bill Selleck. Did I say your name right?
Yes, you did.
All righty. 1 point for me, who is the Director of Technology at Hillbrook School up in Los Gatos in our own beautiful state of California. And Annie Makala. Did I say your name right?
Yes.
Oh, I'm two for two. Who is the new director at the Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Hillbrook School. And Bill is an Apple Distinguished Educator. And one of the reasons we asked him on is because he has been involved in a camp using Swift for teaching coding. And anybody who listens to the podcast often knows that I am not a fan of fake teaching kids to code. And it sounds like he's doing a real teaching kids to code. And he's also known for using audio and video to teach in the classroom. He does a course on iTunes U. And he also is involved in the makerspaces at Hillbrook School. Is that all right, or did I make some of that up?
That sounds great.
And Annie came from originally Middlebury University.
Middlebury College.
Middlebury College in Vermont. And she told me they have a campus in Monterey, so I guess Middlebury is just like restricting themselves to beautiful places. So if you're in Kansas, sorry, you're screwed. No Middlebury for you. And now she's gone from all the way from second graders to college students and back again. So we're going to open right up with some questions that we had for either one of you about how important do you see this whole concept of makerspaces? And we're hearing a lot about makerspaces. I've been in education forever, and every few years there's an answer to everything. And the makerspace seems to be this year's. But you seem to be doing it right, from what I can tell. Can you tell a little about how you use that concept in your school?
Yeah, so I would agree with you that it's one of the later educational trends. But at Hillbrook, we've been making, I think, since we've been around 81 years. So one of my favorite parts, we have a village, so houses that are about 20 feet tall that our students, I think in the 60s, ended up making themselves. They went down to the bank and got a loan, and that was their math class for 6 months, and their engineering class and their science class was to actually build the village. So we've been making for quite a while. We've had a makerspace, as we kind of refer to makerspaces now, for 7-8 years now. And it actually started when we got rid of the computer lab. Do you remember those monitors that weighed like 30 pounds that could crush a small child?
Right. So we got the iPads the year they came out. We piloted them immediately with seventh grade.
Got rid of the computer lab and thought, how might we use this space? And so initially we kind of had half of it as a flexible classroom and partnered with Brettford Furniture, and they donated some furniture. Put whiteboards up, and the other half, we just put in some hand tools, lots of cardboard, and just open up the space to see how people might use it. And it slowly evolved into what we typically call just a maker space, where you have just the really quick prototyping tools. But I think it's not so much about the tool, it's about the mindset of the school, of the teacher, and of the students. And the idea is that it's not about a curriculum, it's not about the hardware or the tools or whatever it is. It's the mindset that students can make things. And it's a mindset that we use the makerspace.
We call it the Idea Lab or the iLab, mostly in fifth grade science.
And so actually looking at it through a lens of, as a scientist, how do you make things? And as you go through the design process, what sort of problems can we introduce to students that they can actually build and learn science through making, through building, through engineering, through asking questions, and from like a bias of empathy, how do you actually build something that's designed for someone and actually meets their needs? So in a nutshell, that's what our fifth grade science program is. And bigger picture, making happens, I think, junior kindergarten through eighth grade on campus.
And I always like to jump in just for our people who are listening who aren't completely familiar with the concept of a makerspace. And can you explain it to them? Because I'm sure you're far better at breaking it down to people than we probably are.
Yeah, so I'll just assume
we're kind of thinking about the makerspace that most people are talking about when they're saying makerspace in, you know, in 2017.
So it tends to be a mix between really high-tech and really low-tech. So low-tech is lots of hand tools, things that a middle school student wouldn't really need much training on, you know, screwdriver, handsaw, those types of things. Lots of cardboard, lots of duct tape, lots of hot glue guns, and then also a mixture of some really high-tech. So whether that's a, you know, soldering iron, 3D printer, we also have a laser cutter, so a little of both, so that you're able to very quickly prototype and make something that works, and I like to think of something that would work actually within like a 45-minute class period.
You know, I wonder how much of this is just rebranding or renaming things, because I was just on the Standing Rock Reservation last week, and I met with this amazing woman, Sue Isbell, who coordinates 4-H there. And in Solon High School, which is probably the size of one of your little village buildings your students made, no, I'm serious, they have an entire almost factory. You can order t-shirts made with, on their screen printers, they have 16 needle with different colors embroidery machines. They have machines for laminating and making iPad covers and making mouse pads. But that's all kind of what the 4-H or Votech used to be. And now it seems like some of those things are going on in schools, and we're calling them a makerspace, but it's something, I don't know. My question is, are we getting back to something we used to do, or is it really a new thing?
Well, I think we've been doing it as a school for 81 years. I'm not 81 years old. I don't think you are either, right?
But, you know, as really a school, good for think, your age if you are.
I know, right? You know, that's something that we've always had it at our roots, I think. And so it's always been a big part of the culture of Hillbrook School. And I think maybe bigger picture in the United States, there's this trend towards getting back to using our hands for things. I think just pedagogically that, and it's really about putting learning in context. So if you're going to learn math, like, whatever, you can learn how to multiply it. But if you actually need to use those skills to make something, you're really going to understand it. So I think it's more of a shift of more interdisciplinary work and putting learning in context in ways that I think we've gotten away from.
Yeah, I would also add, we're seeing a similar sort of parallel movement in the entrepreneurial space when we think of makerspaces as also a place for community. So when you look at the rise in entrepreneurs who are renting offices and impact hubs or the WeWork buildings, in which they're really seeking both kind of the support of other people working in this space and doing this kind of work, but also the physical infrastructure that supports that kind of work. I think the makerspace, both in a K-12 school, is similar to the way we think about the spaces that we're creating for small businesses, that you're looking for input from other students. You're looking for both kind of the physical tools to do the work, but then also the support that comes with doing this work surrounded by other students.
It always makes me wonder, though, as somebody who spent most of my career writing software and you know, locked in my own office, I'm happiest. How do you accommodate those students who are maybe more introverted, that don't want to work on a team, that just want to sit over in the corner and code and maybe every now and then ask somebody for a piece of artwork? I mean, our office is probably half people like that, and I'll bet your school has students like that. How do you work with them?
Let me take it.
Yeah, hop on.
So part of the goal, I think we're really lucky to be on a campus in which a lot of the learning happens outdoors. So our campus really has classrooms that are indoor-outdoor, and we find students often in pockets, you know, whether it's sitting at a picnic table, off down by the amphitheater, off in the woods. We really push students to think about being in the spaces in which they learn and work best for these independent type projects. I think the benefit of having the infrastructure in place is students can come and go, and we can set up the classroom based on student choice. So the iLab never looks exactly the same day to day. In fact, that was a big part of the creation of the iLab, was to have movable furniture, to be sure it was positioned on a place on campus where there was access to quiet learning spaces, but also that the teacher wasn't seen as somebody that stood in front of the classroom and kind of explain the project for the day, but rather as an addition to kind of the community that was being created in the iLab.
Yeah, and I would add to that that, you know, at Hillbrook, we put student choice and engagement at the center of everything we do, and it's not 100% of the time, right? You know, often, and I would say much more than in many other schools, students do have choice about where they work and how they work and whom they work with. But also, I think just like in the real world, right, there's times when you really do need to work with people. So it's that kind of flexibility of giving that choice, but then also having some structure within that so that students, you know, are forced to work on collaborative projects.
So can you give us an example of one, like what's something that a project that happened at your school that you just thought, this was so cool, I want to tell everybody about it?
Where to start?
Like picking your favorite kid, isn't it?
Yeah, I know it is. Well, I'll talk about the one that comes to mind because ISTE submissions were just last week, right? Laura Nielsen is a first grade teacher, and she did an entire design unit. She called it the Problem Investigators. And so we have two sections of first grade. So both first grade classrooms pooled together, and they started off. It's in some ways
it's a really classic design thinking process.
Start off by asking the community, adults and students and parents, what problems are there in the world? Right? It could be super broad. It could be on campus. So a group that I ended up working with, the problem they found is that people that are new to campus actually didn't know where stuff was. Right? Other ones, you know, thought, wow, like we have a problem with dogs and how we deal with adoption and, you know, kind of that whole world. And so they just ended up pooling maybe 600 different post-it notes with, you know, here's a problem I see, from very local to global problems. And they got together and they sorted through it. And this, you know, this took months, and then ended up kind of finding cohorts of students that really had a similar interest, and then found adults that kind of mentored that group. And so the group I was asked to work with, you know, wanted to find a solution for people that are new to campus. And, you know, a couple of months later, when they come up with one of those signs that you can picture, I always think about kind of a Disneyland that's like Egypt, 6,000 miles this way, you know, Eiffel Tower, 3,000 miles that way, kind of a version of that they made for campus. And so, you know, we talked earlier about learning subjects in isolation versus being interdisciplinary. With this one, we ended up doing some pretty serious math with these first graders, where you get one of those wheels that's on a stick that measures things in feet. And so they measured everything from this one point. So we had to first decide, you know, as a new person to the school, what is your starting point, right? So that's where our poll is going to be. And they measured, like, here's how far it is to the gym because they might want to see a game. Here's how far it is to first grade because, well, I guess because we're in first grade, right? And just all these key points on campus, and measured it in feet and really spent a lot of time. And they did it twice and got two different answers and talked about why that was, and then actually designing it and looking at what a good sign looks like and then how we're going to create that. And initially it was just, hey, Mr. Sella, can you laser cut this for us? And the answer was no. You know, it was, what do you want me to make? So they prototyped it just very quickly on a piece of paper, then actually to scale on a piece of cardboard. And then I took that piece of cardboard and we measured it and rebuilt it within CorelDRAW and then sent it to the laser cutter and went through that entire process. And, you know, there were maybe eight different groups that did eight different projects, but it was that same thing, from finding out what needs there are in our community to actually trying to create a solution. And just, it was a blast to be a part of.
And one of the things that, as you were talking, jumped out to me is just when you actually listen to kids and you hear what their ideas are and what their feedback is and what their thoughts are, and how that often tends to vary from what you're probably coming in thinking of as an adult, and how often that tends to get lost sometimes in the traditional education system.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what about you, Annie? What's the coolest thing you've worked on lately?
Oh, man, that's a great question. You know, one of the projects, since I'm new this year and really just getting to know the Hillbrook community, one of the exciting projects that we're currently working on is understanding what the programming for the Scott Center for Social Entrepreneurship is going to look like, both this year but then into the future. And one way that we're thinking about partnership, which is deeply tied to both what's happening on campus, but then also the work we're going to be doing in the local community, is we have a small satellite office at the WeWork downtown San Jose. It's called WeWork Valley Towers. And one of the benefits of having this office space in downtown San Jose is that it happens to be around the corner from the San Jose Tech Shop, where we also have a membership. So we've been thinking about both kind of the urban versus more rural environment. Hillbrook is at the base of the Santa Cruz Mountains on 14 acres, beautiful, access to a lot of outdoor space. And then in juxtaposition to downtown San Jose, thinking through what kind of design projects our students will have access to that can, and then, you know, also rethinking the use of space. So what can happen on campus that then that learning could be extended both to the WeWork space and the tech shop, and thinking of those three spaces in collaboration. We've had some really early ideation and brainstorming that might look like something as simple as partnering with a local dentist's office in downtown San Jose, in which the dentist presents a challenge of, you know, kids under the age of 10 have a really hard time sitting still in the office chair. And who better to kind of tackle this design challenge than a group of 9 and 10-year-olds here at Hillbrook? But part of the goal would be we'd go visit the dentist's office. We'd begin to build a partnership with this person that was built in empathy and built in the human-centered design process. That then could be extended through our tech shop. We might go there and prototype, you know, a design of a certain type of chair or a certain type of experience that somebody going to the dentist would have that would look quite different than a 9 or 10-year-old's experience going to the dentist today. So these are all very much in ideation, early stage thinking, but being able to reimagine the spaces in which students learn, and knowing that our WeWork office, where there are over 200 San Jose entrepreneurs working every day, is around the corner from the San Jose Tech Shop, has opened so many doors, really exciting types of thinking, and the connection between the physical kind of prototyping that would happen at the tech shop in connection to the larger strategic type thinking that might happen at the WeWork space.
I like your idea of working in all kinds of different spaces. I think about how many kids who maybe had trouble in school because it was difficult for them to sit down 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and just do what they're told, as opposed to, like, I would have trouble with that now. I mean, I had trouble with it when I was in school. But I love your idea of if you want to go and work outside at the picnic table, or if you want to go work downtown in the WeWork space, that you could vary that up, because I think that's what a lot of entrepreneurs do. I very seldom spend 3 days in a row sitting in my office all day. I like coding, but there's also a lot of other things involved in going out, meeting with clients, you're meeting with people who use our games, talking to kids, because they will tell you, why don't you have canoeing in here? Or that game was too hard.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's part of what people actually do when they build products.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exciting. You know, a lot of our work with the Scott Center for Social Entrepreneurship is also a lot of talk around entrepreneurship has been internationally in emerging market countries, specifically when we talk about social entrepreneurship. And the Scott Family Foundation was really great about pushing us to think about what our impact could be in our own backyard. So, you know, very rarely do we have opportunities at this point for our students to be in the San Jose community, to be in Salinas Valley or Watsonville. And yet, you know, these are 15, 20 minutes, 45 minutes at max, places that we can access in a school day, you know, for whether it's an hour or 3 hours. It's really opening our students' eyes to these spaces, both as part of their own community and also as spaces where they have a lot to learn.
Well, and that idea of introducing them to entrepreneurship early, I think, is so key, because it starts to shift a mindset and a thinking. I think so often people say, oh, I've decided I want to be an entrepreneur, but don't really have any idea at all what anything behind that is. And to kind of introduce them to that in that school environment, when they can start actually thinking about the skills and, you know, putting into action actually what they're learning in the classroom, is such an important part of the process, as opposed to, it sounds like a cool thing to be when you're, you know, getting out of college and having no real understanding as to what actually goes into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
A lot of people don't, even after they've worked for many years, have any idea. You know, you're exposing kids to something that people often don't get until their 40s. In fact, someone will probably have her on the podcast in the next few weeks. She is a friend of mine. She's starting a new business, and she told me, I've for 20 years gone in and picked up a paycheck. I mean, she's done a lot more than that. She's done a great job. But she said, I have no idea on how to go out and get businesses or how to find out what the need is in the market. I've just gone in, done my job, done it well, and picked up a paycheck every 2 weeks. And there's a whole lot to being an entrepreneur. So kudos to you for getting that young.
Yeah, we get a lot of crazy stares, definitely. In my previous work, when I told my team and kind of people in the social entrepreneurship space, hey, we're launching this Center for Social Entrepreneurship, it's at a JK-8 school, they were like, what? How are you going to teach that to, you know, are you going to ask second graders to start a business? That seems crazy. And clearly that's not our goal, that all second graders will be starting businesses. I think our goal is that we will begin to build an entrepreneurial mindset and democratize who sees themselves as entrepreneurial from a young age. And, you know, similar to the muscles that we build in other types of learning, we need to be building these muscles from an early age, so that risk tolerance, the ability to understand communities that you're not a part of, build meaningful partnerships, have commitment long-term to the work that you want to do. You know, that's all really exciting. And as the example that Bill gave you with the first grade class, you know, this can start really young. And in fact, kindergartners, first graders, second graders, they're craving this type of learning.
Oh, I believe it. Maria has a 9-year-old that does voiceovers and testing for our games. And yeah, she's always negotiating with me. Well, how much should I get paid for this? I heard you pay $50 for voiceovers. You only offered me $20. I'm going to go talk to my mom. So yeah, she's
That's
all
awesome.
Out.
We'll be right back after this.
Did you know that 92% of U.S. homes have a computer? Yes. Yes, they do. And 43% of homes have a child under 18. Why aren't more kids playing educational games on those computers? Because they suck. The educational games, not the kids. Until now, download Spirit Lake or Fish Lake. Check out Forgotten Trail or Making Camp with no download required. All of our games are under $10, teach math and social studies. Let your child play on a real computer and learn real-life math. If you're on Steam, be the coolest aunt, uncle, big brother, or sister on the block and download Fish Lake. The little rugrat can play on your computer, learn fractions, and you can get some peace while you talk on the phone to Vin.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
I'm Anne-Maria DeMars, and we still have our two amazing guests from Hillbrook School.
This is where we're doing the arm gesture.
Yeah, this is where the arm gesture that you can't see comes in. You say your names.
Annie Makala.
And Bill Selleck.
So during the break, we're talking about iTunes U, which no longer exists. I was devastated to learn. Oh, it's one of those things I was meant to go to more and didn't. So, Bill, what motivated you to put a course up on iTunes U, and now what are you doing with it?
Yeah, so back in the day, I was teaching a course called Video in the Classroom through Azusa Pacific University. It was a graduate educational technology course, and this was in the days before LMSs, learning management systems, where there's like a really clear way to share multimedia content with students. And so I did two things to try and just make it easier for students to be able to access material, whether they were in my class or had taken it and, you know, 2 years later recently got some funding, or, you know, just went to a new school that had some good audio or video gear, they'd be able to go back to it. So I wanted to make it open. I wanted to make it free. And so the first was just to create kind of a website within my website, BillSelleck.com, where they could just always go to it, click on EDUC 514, and have links to kind of all the resources. And then realized that wasn't an easy way to get content onto the iPad. And so iTunes U at the time was a great way to do that. So you were able to actually upload kind of all the how-tos, all the tutorials, all the examples, anything you might want to actually annotate or draw on, you know, thinking storyboards, just all that content. So iTunes U is a great resource for that. So I just mirrored everything into iTunes U. Students could go through it. They could watch stuff. They could save it locally to the iPad. And now, I think it's been about a week or two that iTunes U no longer exists. They just converted it to podcasts. And if you didn't know, podcasts will do audio, video, PDFs, and links. And iTunes U is actually the same thing. So it's still there. People can still, you know, access all those resources if they want to have video, you know, in their own classrooms.
I did something similar with the graduate courses I teach with Live Binders, where mm-hmm. I kind of just did it for my own classes, where I would link to the videos that I did on YouTube or link to different resources, because, as you said, the student might be using it when they're in the course, but then they graduate and they go on somewhere else, and so it would be something they could link back to as opposed to specifically on the school site.
Yeah, one of my favorite examples of that recently actually was just a shared note-taking Google Doc. This was with Concordia University in Irvine, and we were meeting up in the Bay Area with a face-to-face class. So we meet for like 4 hours, and in 4 hours, nobody's going to pay attention the entire time, right? So we just had a Google Doc for 9 weeks together and just put a heading for each week, collaboratively took notes, kind of had side conversations sometimes. Other people had links that kind of were anecdotal to this. And to this day, I still get some students that was about 2 years ago that just will randomly reach out on Twitter or Snapchat or somewhere and say, hey, you know, thank you so much for that Google Doc of our shared resources. I still reference that. There's a great resource I found that I needed for today. So I think just the ability to have something even simple like a shared Google Doc can really transform a classroom if it's the resource when you need it.
Well, we use an internal wiki for that. And I want to apologize here publicly to Chris at USC, who was the manager in information technology services when I was there, when they first came up with having an internal wiki. And we all mocked him mercilessly and said, this is going to be useless and we're not going to do it. And then he went over our heads and got it added that no project was finished until it was added to the wiki. And after we had all that stuff on the wiki, we all went and checked it all the time. So Chris, you were right. I was wrong. And now we do that internally. So it sounds like very similar to your collaborative doc. And you're right, those things turn out to be so useful and you never want to do them because you're busy and then you're always glad you did them later.
Yeah.
Well, and one other thing I want to talk about, especially because once I start this, Anne Maria will get on her rant, is the work you guys do in, you know, teaching coding to kids. So you guys are using a Swift camp. Because one of the things that we talk about sometimes on this podcast is just this idea of teaching actual coding. You know, sometimes these people say, oh, my kid's taking coding. And I'll say, oh, well, what language are they learning? Well, they're not really learning any languages, but they're moving a dot, you know, around a screen. And just the idea that then they come away thinking that they're knowing how to code. And just, I guess I will let you go, Amory, on this, but that you guys are actually teaching kids coding and the difference there.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between some of those conceptual logic, if-then statements, moving a dot, which I would consider as similar to coding as pre-algebra is to calculus. They're both, it's certainly required, but it's not the same thing. So you can go ahead and tell me I'm wrong or tell me, I mean, your Swift camp sounds amazing. Can you just tell us about it?
Yes, I can. So I'm trying to think about the timing. About a year or so ago, Apple introduced Swift Playgrounds, and it was an iPad-friendly way to introduce students to the coding language Swift. So similar
to a lot of kind of the drag and drop
block-based coding methods, you were able to just, with zero experience, move in. You had this beautifully rendered 3D environment, and your guy in the very, very first game went, move forward, move forward, move forward, collect gem. But the big difference between this and some of the other block-based programming is that you actually saw the code. So it was one word, M-O-V-E, and then capital F, F-O-R-A-R-D, and then a semicolon. So it prompts you, just like when you're typing on your phone or iPad, to have that auto-suggest. It auto-suggests the code. So you don't have to type. You can. But from day one, minute one, you actually are typing in Swift. And from there, you're able to very quickly, you know, scaffold your way up and get to really, really complicated different types of games within Swift Playgrounds. And then beyond that, Apple has a whole other section of app development with Swift. So for students, you know, even at a K-8, they will go through, you know, learning to code 1 and 2 and then to the app development with Swift and then move into Xcode and start creating their own apps. So it's still a lot. It's still really intimidating. It's something I really struggle with as an educator and not, you know, an official coder that it does this for a living. But there's something I think that's inherently powerful about coding in a language that you can actually build an app on. I've always seen a disconnect between some of the block-based programming and an actual app. It's felt more distant, but with Swift Playgrounds, there's still a very, very long way to go. But from day one, minute one, you're able to actually start coding in Swift. And I think that's really empowering for students.
Yeah, that's what I really love about it. The idea is that, yes, coding is you're actually typing something. There are statements and that there are conventions. And like you said, there's a connection between the code and what happens. And you're right. I feel like many of those block-based languages hide that connection to the detriment of children learning.
We'll be right back after this.
You can be too successful.
How so?
Our latest games have parents suggesting we get endorsements from YouTube celebrities, have professional gamers stream us on Twitch. They point out where we aren't the virtual reality level of Call of Duty.
Yet.
The point is, our games are so much more, well, game-like than the average educational games that people forget that what you really should be comparing these games to are math worksheets.
Yeah, I mean, you can have your kid sit down and do math workbooks for 20 minutes, if you can even get them to do that. Or you can let them play Fish Lake, which they'll probably ask you to let them keep playing after 20 minutes.
Or you can play yourself. You know you are never going to pick up one of those workbooks again for the rest of your life. Still, do you remember how to reduce fractions to lowest terms, multiply and divide fractions?
If not, play Fish Lake before Mia or Connor or Aiden or Joe gets home from school and ask for your help with their homework. Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. We are now at our tip section of the podcast, which tends to be, from people we hear, their favorite part, because maybe Anne-Marie and I are talking less, but also because we get really great insights from the people who we have on our show. And so what tip do you have? And when we say tip, it can be anything. We had someone who was one of the best Call of Duty players in the world talk about when we said, what's your tip? And he said, you know, compound interest, make sure you're saving money for retirement, things like that. It can be anything. But what is one tip that you, both of you, have found that really has been transformative, and either in a big way or a small way, that you wish you'd known or now get the chance to share with other people?
And it can be anything. Like Mary said, you can have, you know, dating advice we've had people give us. So whatever your tip is, we're open.
I think it's so important to show your work. Particularly as an educator, it's so easy to be disconnected from other educators, especially if you're in the classroom. You know, you spend so much of your day not with other adults. And even if you do spend other time co-teaching with other people, you don't really get to see other teachers or other educators often unless you go to a big conference. So when I say show your work, I mean just document what you're doing as an educator, how you're doing it, what you're reading, what you're thinking, share what other people are doing. And it doesn't have to be this thing of like, I'm going to make this really beautiful video and it's going to take a week to edit it. It can be just a photo. Actually, during this podcast, I don't know if you noticed, I took a photo, threw it out actually onto Snapchat, and another one onto the Hillbrook CTE Twitter account, sharing what we're doing right now, right? Just, you know, here's what we're talking about. Here's what we're excited about. And just continuing to do that. So always a bias towards sharing, towards connecting with other people, towards, you know, just sharing what you're doing.
Always say yes to tea. That's actually a tip that I got from a friend, and it's one of my new favorite tips, which is that you never know where a conversation might lead, and tea is always a good idea no matter what time of day it is. So sharing both yourself and the space to have a conversation with someone else, I think, is one of the most powerful and important parts of self-care, remaining human, and just continuing to be able to learn from other people.
I think that's a great idea. And just so you know, if either of you are ever in Santa Monica, there's a lot of British expats who have relocated here. So there's a couple of places that actually have tea. So I'd totally be up for that.
So we can have tea together.
Yeah, we can have tea. So if you're in Santa Monica, hit me up. Also,
awesome.
Love it.
Yeah, to go back to your idea of showing your work. You know, when I was young, people who listen to this podcast often know I came from a very unlikely background to end up anywhere other than Chino Women's Prison. And I definitely did not know what people on the 12th floor of buildings in Santa Monica did, or how somebody started a company, or how they got there. So we do a section in our blogs on our website called Startup Diaries. And I will just write about what I'm doing that day. You know, whether it was lately I was in 9 different cities in 10 days because I was visiting schools and I was speaking at conferences, or I might just do some problem that I solved with functions, you know, getting the language to flip over from English to Spanish and back again in a game. But it's sort of like a watch me work. And we did that sort of as a public service. So anybody who's thinking of being a tech entrepreneur, or any teachers in schools that maybe, you know, you guys are up in near Silicon Valley, so you've got access to a lot of people, but not every kid does. And so, yeah, we just kind of do a watch us work, and we'll throw up exactly like you. Here's what we're doing today. So I think those are both brilliant tips. I really appreciate you coming in, especially because you had to fight in traffic to get here. And I totally know how that is, being in LA. So
yeah, sorry, I was late. I was like, yeah, well, you know.
No apologies necessary. Timing. Believe me, I have done my, if I had all of the hours back in my life that I'd spent waiting on the 101, the 405, I'd probably live another 20 years.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.